almost everybody has a story about an animal that had a behavior they couldn't explain. Tail chewing, aggression, listlessness. Our next guest traces the history of mental illness in animals and says there's a lot we can learn about ourselves by understanding what's going on in the minds of animals.
Laurel Braitman joins us now. She's written for The New Inquiry, Pop-Up Magazine, and Orion. She's the author of the new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you start out with the story of your Bernese Mountain Dog, Oliver, and the day he jumped out of your fourth-floor apartment window. What happened that day?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. We left him alone, my ex-husband and I, just for about a day and a half with a human that he really loved, our downstairs neighbor. And we'd have been gone only about 2 hours, and his caregiver went out to go to the farmer's market. And as soon as Oliver realized he was alone, he went into a huge panic. And he ended up pushing the window air conditioning unit in our kitchen out of the way. He chewed and clawed a hole through a metal window screen, somehow held the sash open, and then he jumped out of our apartment.
Oh, it's amazing that he was able to do that, which shows the anxiety that he was going through. And this was your first really big incident, sounds like, with Oliver, who was anxious, he was destructive and compulsive. How did you deal with this host of issues that he had?
We tried everything. We came back from that wedding as fast as we could, and we went to find him at the vet clinic. And I was so sad and confused and not sure what to do next. And I asked the attending veterinarian what to do, and he looked at me and said, move to a first-floor apartment. And then he gave me a prescription for Valium and Prozac. Not for me, for Oliver.
That's what launched you sort of on the journey of this book. You were baffled because you couldn't ever really figure out what Oliver was feeling. You couldn't ask him, which brings up the question, how do we ever figure out what's going on in the minds of animals when it comes to their mental health?
Well, it's always going to be a mystery. But, you know, what I realized while researching this book was it's often a mystery, even with our human family members and the people we're dating. You know, just because you ask someone that you're in a relationship with how they feel doesn't mean that they can tell you. They may not even have words for their feelings themselves. And that's what actually underlies so much of psychotherapy. So it's not actually that much of a stretch to use observation to try and understand emotional thunderstorms or turmoil in other creatures, as long as you're a careful observer and you don't overproject, or as long as you, how should I say, you don't see exactly what you already think you're looking for. I mean, you have to be pretty open-minded, and you have to know the normal baseline for the creature at hand. So that's why so many of us see these things in our pets, is because we know them really well, and so we know what their normal is, and so we can tell when they seem depressed or compulsive, for example.
So you're getting at a term that's been sort of a dirty word in science for a long time, anthropomorphism, the idea that we project human behaviors and motivations on animals. And you say that we've inherited a bias against identifying with other animals that isn't useful, and it's high time we discard it. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that as human animals, trying to understand the motivations or the feelings behind the behavior in other creatures, we have to project. You know, we will always be a human animal imagining what it's like to be another animal. It's impossible to think about your dog without thinking about your dog in human terms. You know, we use human language to describe what they do. We have human feelings. That's really the only thing we can do. You can't take your brain out of your head and put it in a jar and use it to think about other animals in a somehow unbiased fashion. So I think that we can either anthropomorphize well or we can anthropomorphize poorly. And I'd like to see us anthropomorphize well, because when you're guessing about the emotional state of an animal that you know really well, you're probably right.
Darwin was at the vanguard of the idea of animal emotions. What did he have to say about this?
He believed other animals could be insane. He thought that other animals didn't go insane as often as humans, which is interesting. But he thought other animals, and I mean other animals across the board, really, from chimpanzees to horses to some rodents, he believed that all of us experienced emotions. The only thing that he believed that other animals didn't experience was shame. And I think that's actually a function of his time in the Victorian period. People were busy feeling guilty about a lot of things.
Well, you tell a story about a chimpanzee named John Daniel who was adopted by a London family, and his rich and complex emotional life, on the outside, you know, it sort of seemed to parallel what a human child might have felt. Can you tell us about him and what happened?
Sure. John Daniel was basically kidnapped in the Congo in the 19-teens. I'm not exactly sure what year. No one is. And he was sent on a ship to London, where he was purchased by a department store to be a display and what the department store owners would hope would be a really good Christmas present for someone, and kept in the front of the department store. And he was purchased by a woman and her uncle, and he was raised like a human child inside of a London home. And he did things like play the drums. He ate jam on toast every day. He poured tea for himself. He put trash in the trash can, and he had lots of human friends. And he was actually the first gorilla that really showed the Western world that gorillas weren't bloodthirsty brutes, but that they were affectionate vegetarians. Because before that, the only gorillas people knew were gorillas they ran into when they were hunting them. So, of course, they were aggressive. But John was a sweet, emotional creature who was a lot like a person.
And what happened to him in the end?
Well, John was growing, and you can't keep a male silverback gorilla in downtown London, even
silverback
if they're really nice.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, his humans needed to find somewhere else for him to go, and they thought that they were giving him to a sanctuary where he would live out his life in a peaceful garden. But instead, it turns out that they were giving him to Ringling Brothers Circus. And Ringling sent him to New York City, and they put him up in Madison Square Garden in a cage on display. And within 3 weeks of arriving in New York City, John had died of a broken heart.
That's so interesting, because hearing that story, you know, it sounds like a story of heartbreak. You can imagine this animal who was pretty much a family member, and then all of a sudden he's back to being objectified, being this animal without touch and companionship. So is it wrong to read his story like that?
Well, I mean, I use the word heartbreak because his death was front page news in the New York Times at the time. And his death unfolded in the aftermath of World War I, where the assumption was that lots of humans could die from heartbreak too, and homesickness. So that was considered a physical illness at the time that could weaken and kill someone. So people thought about homesickness then a little bit differently than they do now. And so I don't think it's unreasonable. Certainly that's what everyone around him thought. But also, you know, if we combine that with what we know today about depression and sadness, he also likely had a really weakened immune system. Who knows what he was exposed to on the boat on the way over? He was so sad he wasn't eating. All he did all day was scan the crowd for faces of people that he might know, according to observers. So he was definitely sad, and that affects our physiological well-being. And it's likely it made him suffer from something else, too.
So you mentioned a silverback gorilla who dies reportedly of heartbreak and homesickness, and then your dog who was given Prozac and I think you said Xanax. What kind of overlap is there between human psychiatric medications and conditions and animals?
Well, really, there's so much, and what I learned really early on while researching all of this stuff was so much of what we know about the unhinged human mind, both how we diagnose and think about certain mental illnesses and also how we treat them, stems from our observations of other animals. So after Darwin, there was a move away from talking about these sorts of emotional states in other animals. It was seen as slightly less scientific. But at the same time, all of these creatures were inside labs, and we were doing things like testing our psychopharmaceuticals on them. We were doing behavioral studies to find out what happens. You know, if you ignore an infant rhesus monkey, turns out they don't turn into an emotionally healthy adult. They may not even develop cognitively in the ways they need to. So on the one hand, we can deny these things, and we have been, you know, for generations, because it seems in some ways or has seemed as sentimental. But on the other hand, they've been the most helpful proxies for understanding the human mind. So I think we've tacitly acknowledged these emotional states and disorders in other animals for quite a long time.
So does that mean the dam is bursting and we're, you know, opening the gate to allow animals into this area where all the emotions that we acknowledge as humans live?
I think that's true. You know, I think we're in this sort of golden age of flowering science around animal emotions. And in a lot of ways, it's a return to the late 19th century when Darwin and a lot of his colleagues were writing about these things. I don't actually think Darwin would have been surprised by a lot of what's going on today. You know, he didn't have an MRI machine to put his dogs into, but he did describe dejection and happiness in his dogs. So it's not, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. But how we're talking about these things definitely is. And it makes good scientific sense, frankly. You know, most mental illness in the United States are various manifestations of fear and anxiety disorders. And fear and anxiety is something that we share with most of the animal kingdom because it's healthy. It keeps us away from danger. The problem is when we get scared, and by we, I mean, you know, belugas and hamsters or humans, when we're not actually in a situation of danger, when we're panicking, even though everything's okay. And that's, I think, you know, when we tip into the territory of mental illness and normal life becomes difficult.
We're talking right now with Laurel Breitman. She is the author of the new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you lived with an animal you might consider having a mental illness? Did you see what you might have called anxiety or depression? Do you think it's helpful to draw a line between the animal mind on one side, the human mind on the other? Or can we draw valuable lessons from blurring that line a little bit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Laurel Breitman. She's the author of the new book called Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. We're drawing that link between what's going on in the minds of animals and what it says about us as humans.
And we want to hear from you with your questions, maybe your experiences dealing with an animal, maybe a pet exhibiting signs of anxiety, depression, or other mental illness. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers right now. We've got Sherry with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. You know, my dog is a miniature pincher, and she's older. She's 11, and she also has diabetes, so insulin, she has to take insulin. But she started developing anxiety a couple of years ago. Now, she was always a high-strung dog, but it was, at first, I was very resistant to her taking medication, but she was miserable. I mean, she was sick. She was so nervous. You know what I mean? And nothing was calming her. No amount of walking, no amount of exercise, no special pheromone sprays. You know, nothing was working. And so now she takes the anti-anxiety medication. She is so much better. I actually posted on Facebook, you know, for people. I said, anybody out there who has anxiety, who, you know, is concerned about taking medication, if it, you know, if it does half for you what it did for this dog, then you shouldn't feel bad about taking it. She's not, you know, a zombie or anything. She's just better. Hmm. You know, she's not nervous and unhappy like she was. She's much better.
So that's transformed her life. Sherry, thank you so much for that call. Sounds a lot like your dog Oliver, at least with the anxiety. I don't think the medications worked for Oliver. But what do we know about how antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications work on animals?
Well, that story makes me so happy. I mean, I think as with humans, they can work. They can work spectacularly, but you really have to look at the individual animal's experience. And one anti-anxiety medication that works for one miniature pincher is not going to work for another one. And some animals will respond to the psychopharmaceuticals and others won't, and they'll just actually need more exercise or time with their humans. So, you know, if you know any person suffering from anxiety, no two people's anxiety is the same. We can draw some generalizations about what's helpful, but really you have to try all the tools at hand. And but the drugs can be really helpful. You know, I get concerned when they're the first line, because oftentimes a creature's anxiety, just like a person, you know, is stemming from something in their environment or an unhealthy relationship in their life or not enough physical activity. But if you've addressed all of those things, then absolutely you should try psychopharmaceuticals.
And Laurel, you write that the orcas at SeaWorld take Xanax regularly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how regularly, but definitely when they've removed calves, from the mothers, and the mothers are suffering. And that's a case where I feel like the use of these drugs is unconscionable. You shouldn't have to medicate an animal into compliance in a situation that is literally driving them insane. So these drugs can be deployed as tools, or they can be deployed in a lot of ways as they were in, say, women in the 1950s as behavioral control. Where someone is being medicated into compliance with a system that's not making them happy. So using these drugs in display facilities for animals who are just miserable as display creatures, I think is more problematic. That said, sometimes they can be used for a time to get a creature through a difficult spot. Much in the way that, say antipsychotics can be used for some people or other drugs, they can put a pause on your despair, your anxiety, long enough for you to be able to begin therapy. And then you can wean yourself off the drugs.
Let's go back to our callers now. Greg is with us from Manchez. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I'm a person who's been with animals for most of my life. I'm in my 60s. I've spent a lot of close contact with dogs and horses, and I can just tell you that there's this, they reflect the same degree of emotions that humans. I don't think evolution spared a lot of the other higher animals from the same kind of general patterns. I've seen depression. I've seen anxiety. I've seen all sorts of different emotions on dogs and horses, and I've seen mourning and grief. I've seen all of those things, and I think it's a natural part for everybody, including animals. I remember seeing a squirrel after I shot another squirrel when I was a kid, and that squirrel came over and investigated the corpse of the one I had just shot, and then tried to move it, tried to rouse it, chattered at it, walked around it. It was amazing how much time that animal spent on it, and well, I stopped squirrel hunting after that.
Oh, interesting. Greg, thank you so much for your call and your experiences seeing all kinds of emotions is what he's talking about in the animal world. Do you think, Laurel, that's common if we look at it like that, that we do see the emotions if we're allowed to see them?
Absolutely. Feeling grief when we lose someone close to us is healthy. There's a reason we feel that, because it's the flip side of becoming close and having affection for those other animals that are good to us, that make our lives easy or more pleasurable. So it makes good sense, that humans wouldn't be the only ones to feel emotional pain when we lose someone that we're bonded to. So a lot of this, it does make really good sense. It's hard to admit for a lot of people, because it may force us to deal with other things in our lives, say our food system or the captivity industry, that are inconvenient. We want to believe that we're the only ones, that we're special. And I think we are special. I don't think, say, a squirrel's depression is the same as a person's. But as I mentioned before, no two persons' experience of depression is exactly the same either.
So to move to healing, do animal minds heal the same way that human minds heal? Can we learn things from it?
We can absolutely learn things from them. And that was such a fun part of researching this book. So often people ask me, like, isn't this work so depressing, all this mental illness? I actually think the opposite is true, because I was just floored time and again by so many stories I saw, of elephants cheering up other elephants, or sea lions distracting other sea lions from their compulsions, to dogs cheering up other dogs. And at the end of the day, I actually think humans are the best therapy animals often for our animals. I often felt when I was walking with my own dog that I should be wearing like a therapy human vest, because I was really dedicated to helping him move through the world. But honestly, most things that, particularly when it comes to domestic animals, most things that cheer up your dog are things that are going to cheer you up. More exercise, goofing around, playing tag or hide and go seek, spending less time on your phone and your computer and more time running around. Sometimes psychopharmaceuticals, behavior therapy, new and healing relationships, structure. I mean, these are just bigger than any species, actually, the positive effects they have on us.
Well, you ultimately lost your dog, Oliver. I'm sorry to say, at the end of the book, you know, we find out that he doesn't make it. He has another incident while you're away. But for someone who does have an animal with problems like Oliver, you know, you're not an animal behaviorist, but what are some things that they can try?
Well, I think number one, they should stop feeling too guilty. I mean, I've spent the better part of a decade feeling bad about what happened to my dog, and I tried everything to help him, my ex-husband as well, and we couldn't. And I think that a lot of many hours, many years that you spend with a creature who's maybe a tad bit demented, you know, you feel bad and guilty and responsible. And so I think people should try everything that they can. You know, a lot of the things that we've talked about, they should seek the help of a veterinary behaviorist. You should educate yourself about the natural history of the animal you're trying to help and make sure that as many of their needs are met as possible. But then you should also just relax and realize that all of us are born into the world with various propensities to emotional thunderstorms. And there's only so much that we can do. And you can't love someone through everything, although you can try. And it's just so worth it to try.
Let's take one more quick call. We've got Lori on the line with us from Waterloo. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I was just wondering if you looked into the progressive practices that many shelters are using now to reduce stress in dogs that are kenneled, such as enrichment puzzles and play groups, and teaching the dogs self-calming behaviors such as go-to-mat skills.
All right. Thanks, Lori. Those are good suggestions. What about that, Laurel?
Those are fantastic. Yes, there are a lot of progressive shelters and rescue entities who are trying to do these things. You know, kennel madness, you know, that's not an official term. But that's something that happens. You know, you take an animal, you know, this especially can happen with cats. You take them out of a household where they know what to expect. They have a schedule. They understand the people around them. And you bring them to a shelter where it's loud and noisy and there's no smells. And, you know, the surfaces that their paws are on are completely different. And I think that's responsible for so much emotional distress and eventually behavior problems when they get adopted. So, yes, great shelters are changing all of these things, which is exciting and a wonderful development.
Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Laurel Braitman. She's written for The New Inquiry, Pop-Up Magazine, and Orion. She's the author of Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Can Help Us Understand Ourselves.